So thank you, everybody, for coming today. This is a session called Leading Discussions. And this is one in a series of programs kind of co-sponsored by the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and our Quality Enhancement Program, Read Today, Lead Tomorrow. So this is the final Read Today, Lead Tomorrow session of the school year officially. I have to give regrets for Jay Todd and Elizabeth Cameron, who both in turn had planned to be here and planned to kind of be giving this introduction, but other obligations intervened that just couldn't be gotten away from. So it's my pleasure, though, to welcome Catherine Labor and Linda Rodriguez from the English department here, who are going to share with us their thoughts on what might seem like a deceptively simple concept, reading a book and leading a discussion on the book. Now, you all have a pretty clear agenda of where you want to go with this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Okay. I'm just coming in at the last minute here. So
we're good.
I will be on tap. I'm not going to do much, I guess, except make sure that we wrap up in a timely fashion. So
okay.
I'll give you a 5-minute warning.
Sounds
when we come to 1:00.
We break up at what time?
1:05.
That sounds good.
All right.
That sounds
great. I'll be over here paying dutiful attention and just holler if you
have so much to learn from us.
Excuse me. I might have to shoot out a little early, okay, because I have to be somewhere at once.
We're
going to
make note of that.
Okay.
We understand. We totally understand. We wish we could do that too, but we have to stay up here. Do you want me to just go ahead first?
Yeah.
Okay. We have different approach. Hello. We have different approaches, so I'm just going to be talking about something I had done, and then she's going to actually do something a little bit more interactive, I believe,
mm-hmm.
with y'all. So mine's the just listen to what I did section of the part. So y'all can just chew and finish up, so later on you can participate with her. I guess it was 2 years ago when we got grant money to work on basically making reading a better part of our classes. And Linda and I were chosen for this FACTS grant, both being from English. It just had nothing to do with it. Of course, we all use reading. But my particular approach was to teach a course around the concept of running it like a book club. Now, for the original course that I taught, I had two different sections of 1020. 1020 is our course that involves literature with composition, okay, and they're all freshmen. To make this more like a book club, I had it so that the two different sections met once a week, okay, which was hard for some of the kids, you know, because they're just not quite mature enough. The other ones loved it, so it was kind of hit and miss. And I was able to run this experiment with two classroomfuls. I was able to do this. And I say a classroomful, I had to limit it to 14. And even then, I really wanted to limit it to 10. But just to be able to have everyone speak. Now, with the whole idea of a book club, another thing I did that broke away from the way at least I've traditionally have taught 1020 is that I did not use an anthology. Anthologies are great, they're convenient, okay? But, you know, a book club and an anthology in your lap, and I was having the classes in the lounge on the third floor, the admin annex, that kind of thing. I really wanted that kind of feel with the food and the sitting around, the comfy chairs and such. So I went with novels instead. And basically you see this stayed with what I've been doing this semester. My book club approach, instead of using an anthology, I use a book of poetry, in this case by one poet, Major Jackson, who does enough different kinds of poems that I can get what I need to teach just by using his poetry. One essay, a movie based on that essay, actually it's Saturday Night Fever, which was based on a piece of creative nonfiction, okay? And four novels, and I have basically changed the novels I used this time. Now, what I learned from running it as a book club was, again, the time factor. For some students, they're just not mature enough for the weekly seminar kind of thing. It was really hard for them, even though we did have a break. Something else I learned was that I felt 14 was still a bit much for a discussion group, okay? But there were different reading approaches that I used, and something I want to set up first before I even go into that is that with the book club approach that I use, And I do this basically because I've always hated it when I was a student. I do not do this. We're going to talk about page 1 through 25 today. Well, now we'll talk up to page 50. No, read the book, understand the book, and then talk. Because you don't go to a book club having talked about half the book. You know, read it. It's maddening, you know. So I would tell the students, you're on your own. If you read it all the night before, that's how you want to do it, good for you. If you want to break it up, good for you. You're going to have to figure out this semester how you read best. I'm not telling you how to do this. And I found that with that first approach I did, the students did indeed, a lot of them changed their approach. And by having the students coming from either 1,000 or 1010 and being kind of a mixed group, the ones who were not as good readers were actually kind of getting a little bit more from the ones who were better readers and had better grades. So mixing them together like that was a really good thing. This was not an honors course. I want to bring that up. It was basically just basic 1020, not honors. Okay. I learned what I learned from that. I learned that my students, a lot of them did change their reading approaches because I questioned them in the beginning, questioned them at the end. I wanted to teach this semester because I didn't want to be one of those people that, you know, you get your fax money and you do something once and then you never do it again, especially when I believed in the approach. But administration doesn't like having freshmen take a course once a semester, you know, once a week for basically a three-hour course. They don't like that. So I went ahead and I offered one section of it anyway. It didn't fill up. So it didn't this time. I think I pushed it more the first time. There was more promotion of it this time, and the other teachers were promoting it more too. Oh, it's a new thing. This time I wasn't getting that kind of promotion because it wasn't new. So I went ahead and I kept, you know, I took the one section of 1020, and I said, you know what? Okay, it's going to be a Tuesday-Thursday course, which is not book clubby, but it's better than a three-time-a-week course because it does allow for more time. And I decided to keep the same kind of materials I would be teaching, the book of poetry, the four novels, that kind of thing. And I told the students that we would be dividing into book groups, a Tuesday book group and a Thursday book group. And all I did was I took the roll and said, this one's Tuesday, this one's Thursday. I did just like that. Did not give them a chance to choose. I said, if there's some reason you need to change over, tell me now. I set it up like that, because if you give them too many choices, you know how that goes. I did that, and I said, now on the book club week, we do not meet in our traditional classroom. We meet in the lounge. You only have to come Tuesday if you're a Tuesday, Thursday if you're a Thursday. And yeah, that is less class time, but however, when you've only got 10 people in the room, it's much more intense, and you really get to speak. And I can tell you that the one thing I have come away from in using a book club approach is that I would say most of the students have read everything. Most of the students speak. The only ones who don't speak are the ones who really haven't read anything. And you're always going to have a few of those. You know, you're just always going to have a few who just don't do the work, you know, one or two like that for whatever reason they have. But I found that they were much more interested, they were much more engaged. I have never, ever, in doing the book club approach, had this moment of, well, what did you think of whatever or something? And that moment of silence, you know, and you count. Anyway, or maybe it's the same person who answers over and over again, that kind of thing. Or the person who hasn't even read the book. That reminds me of my cousin, blah, 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 starts talking about something he knows. Haven't experienced that, never a drag on the conversation. They actually converse. They actually treat it the way we treat book clubs. They are excited about, even if they hate the book, they'll talk about it. And that's what a book club does. Okay? So I'm sticking with that approach. I think it actually works better as a twice a week just because of their attention span and such. I think they liked having the once, you know, the four times a week that they went to the special room, that they could eat if they wanted to, that they sat in chairs. They really enjoyed the change, okay? So again, it was a different approach in making reading more pleasurable. Reading, talking about conversation, a more fun thing. You know, I was telling someone the other day, I had this professor back when I was in college, and she would say, I'm trying to teach you to have things to talk about when you go to cocktail parties, to be able to converse about things other than your job. And I would tell my students that. And I said, this is what we're doing. You need to be able to talk about literature and why this worked and why that didn't. And I found that they were much more engaged and actually able to make really good comments and notice things, I think just because of the looser atmosphere. Now, in using approaches, of course, I always use quizzes just because either you read or you didn't. And I always want to know that. And so in addition to the talking, I would always start with the approaches, I mean with the quiz. And I use different forms, and this would kind of help them. It's kind of my way of trying to edge them along to become better readers, okay? Now, for the first book we read, which was Bright Lights, Big City, okay, what I did not give them the words ahead of time, which I know some teachers do. Find, you know, keep an eye out for these kind of words. I didn't do that. But when they came to the room, I gave them the sheet of paper with 20 words in a basic order. Not random, that doesn't work too well. But in a basic order. And I said, write a sentence for each word. It has to make sense. So why am I asking you about the ferret? Why am I asking you about the Bolivian soldiers? Why am I asking you about whatever it is? And it showed me, I could tell you exactly what page they stopped reading. It was amazing. It was really, really good. So that was a way of them being able to, they'd see the word, they'd hook up onto it. I could see what they weren't noticing, the name of a club, you know, because this is about being out in the nightclubs and such. I could see where maybe some of their... Some people didn't get the Bolivian marching powder and the Bolivian soldiers was a reference to cocaine. I could tell that from their answers, but it's not in their experience. They don't know. But in doing this, it also opened up the whole idea of, okay, I asked you about whatever with the drugs with mother and their confusion about the morphine that the mother was using and then the cocaine that was mentioned in the clubs. And because it came up on this, it was able, they were actually able to point it out and see, oh, this is a difference. This is what she was using because she had cancer. This is what was going on in the clubs. I didn't understand that's what they were doing. And so, and again, if it was just their experience getting in the way, I didn't, you know, mark them wrong for that kind of thing. But it was a way of getting them, for the first time out, to realize, oh, wait, she's going to ask things from all the way at the end of the book, too. So it made them realize how far they got. I even sometimes joke that you didn't get past this, did you? Or how could you, you know, obviously you didn't get past such and such because you would have remembered the ferret jumping out of the room and that kind of thing. So that was the approach I used for that. And you can see the quiz grades. And again, they didn't know what was coming at them. I wanted them to kind of, I like to teach by your own mistakes. So they kind of learned from this quiz to see how maybe they should read for next time, to realize they had to pay attention to little details, not picky ones, but just, again, be awake. And then to also realize they'd have to really read the end of the book. Tuesday class is C, Thursday class B minus. First time out the gate, okay. Second Skin is a modernist novel, postmodernist novel by John Hawkes, and it's difficult. But I loved it because it's a weird story. There's rape, there's incest, there's all kinds of stuff going on in this book, okay? And I thought, well, let's see how they do. For this book, what I told them, because I said the language is going to be difficult. John Hawkes writes gorgeously, but it's going to be difficult. So what you do for this, your quiz is annotate the book. If something happens, write it down. You see he's doing something, write it down. The beautiful language will scare you, but you can, it's like poetry. You will physically know, you'll be able to see he's on a boat, he's going to dinner, they're throwing snowballs at them. Write it down. They didn't think they got the book. We see the quiz averages here, C plus and a B, okay? Their annotations were actually not too bad. They actually understood more of the book than they thought they did. And at the end of it, I was able to say, look what you actually got out of this. You actually understood more. And I could tell by reading their books. And then you say, if you don't want to mark your book, just give me the notes. They actually really got through the ones who were going to do it. You always have one or two. But they actually really got, and I was like, look at this. Because they couldn't make that up. They couldn't make that up. So again, it forced them to be engaged. And then they realized, I did understand. It's just a weird book. You know, and sometimes that will be, you're not going to always get clear pictures from books you read. But it led to some really interesting conversations. Okay? We got to Wise Blood by Flannery O'Connor. And I just gave them the book. I said, okay, we'll be talking. I said, it's a weird story. Did not go through, I should point out, with Second Skin, I did go through the first chapter with them, and I gave them the cast of characters so they would know who was going to be coming up, because it's a man looking back on his life. So they had me go in for that first chapter because it was very difficult. Now with WiseBot, I said, you're on your own, you gather together. And when they came in, and it's a weird story, we had 10 questions. And I found they actually did really well on their own. They got things. And I sort of felt like they maybe learned from the annotating experience of it. And you see pretty good grades, A minus and a B plus. And this is not as straightforward a book as Bright Lights, Big City. It's a very odd story of a man who comes back from war and sets up the Church of Christ Without Christ. And in the end, he's literally blinded himself. He's walking with his shoes filled with rocks and glass. He flagellates. He does this whole thing. It's really creepy at the end, okay? All because he's finally found Christ, okay? Bartleby the Scrivener was our final one, and it's a novella, and we just went over that today. And I gave them, again, the traditional quiz, again, hoping that they pick up on stuff on their own, and I did see that a few people had actually written notes as they went along. So they picked up that idea that if I pick up, write notes, I might, again, about what I know is actually going on, they'll do well. But the one thing I did that was different was, at the end of Bartleby the Scrivener, there's the mention of the Office of Dead Letters. And it's an ending that just comes from the moon, but it's there. Basically, Bartleby, he thought, had been asked to hand it, to burn the letters that never got to people. Well, as luck would have it, last week or so, there was a story on AOL or something about, you know, about the man who had sent the proposal in the mail, and they just finally found it. This was after, during World War II. Luckily, his proposal not making it to this woman, she never got it, worked out happily. They still found each other. They still married. But what if it hadn't? And you kind of ties into the end. All I said was, here it is on Blackboard. Cut and paste this into your browser. Go look. You need to know this. It didn't say, now what does it have to do with the book? I wanted to see if they could make connections on their own. Maybe only two people did. So it depends on how much you want to guide them. The one or two people did, because that was one of my quiz questions. It was a bonus. Why did I ask you to watch this clip? What does that have to do with this? So I don't know. Again, that critical thinking jump, which I still want them to be able to do on their own. I think if I had asked them ahead of time, they would have thought, but I wanted them to be able to kind of do that without me saying, now, what is this? And I will tell you, like in today's class, and today's class always does better generally, no, actually, it did do as well as Tuesday's class. I'm surprised. Usually, it's because the conversation's better. When we talked about it, I said, okay, so why was it? Because the letter was lost, okay? The letter was lost. What's the connection? And finally, one girl said, oh, my God! And I said, there you go. Class is over. We can all go. So y'all need to make these connections on your own. This is what we mean by critical thinking. You read this, you apply it to that. So again, some people might have said ahead of time, now how does, and put that. I was hoping they would make the jumps by themselves. You know, for this one they didn't. And I think it was because this one was World War II and this one was this antiquated thing. And they didn't because there wasn't a literal connection. They didn't. But you see, in the end, the Tuesday group's grade average was a B minus. The Thursday's average was B minus. I thought that was pretty good considering how much I was consistently asking them to do more on their own. But if I were grading the conversations they had, conversations they had were A plus. There was never, ever a dull moment. And they really, in talking about the book on their own, you know, as a group, then they really started to get more, which is what we want from teaching anyway. It's not so much the grade you get on the quiz, it's what do you get from the class, and how does this work for you, and how do we connect this? And I found using this approach worked really, really well with getting them to maybe enjoy literature, even the books they didn't like. They could at least talk about it intelligently and realize it's okay not to like something, but what'd you get from it? And what do we get from that? That's it.
Okay, well, I will continue on. We do have some different methods, but we share some things in common, too, so I'll point out some of those things along the way. And so I call this the sort of Socratic method, because it doesn't quite meet the guidelines. So I'll explain the difference. The first quote, I think, is really important. I think it's something we all kind of strive for. The unexamined life is not worth living is a Socrates quote. And I think it very much applies to how we're always trying to get, you know, the students to look critically at everything. But that that term, thinking critically, looking critically, reading critically, I think is kind of abstract too. Even to us, it's kind of hard to explain. So a true Socratic questioning would, there would be no teacher, no instructor, there's no guidance. It is a claim of ignorance all the way through. You claim not to know anything. And so you, it's who, what, you don't guide, you don't suggest, you don't impose your own ideas, you don't play devil's advocate. It's, you know, who, what are you talking about? Explain it to me, I don't understand, kind of questioning. However, that didn't end so well with Socrates. He was charged with a lack of fidelity to the recognized gods of the state and with corrupting the youth. So I decided that's probably not what we want. So that's why I go with the sort of Socratic questioning. The way that I do it, and that I think a lot of people in English do, is we guide. And I think we all know that the students, particularly the lower levels, as they get higher, they're better able to do that. But without guidance, they don't have anything to compare it to. So they don't know where to go with it. We don't have the same kind of education that Socrates did back then. And so, you know, we have to do a little bit more guiding. However, I want to encourage you to bite your tongue, because you will die if you don't, because you can't impose so much that you're force-feeding them the information. And I think that's where it's very, very difficult. It's very difficult to draw that line, because we tend to kind of want to, when they don't answer right away, we're not comfortable with those silences. We want to keep the conversation going, and we have to learn to be comfortable with the silences. The next part of this is, and we're going to do some of this, we're going to have an interactive thing, I just want to introduce it to you first. The one thing that I definitely do, as Kathy does, is I never have students read something in class and then we talk about it, as if that's their first reading. We may read something in class and talk about it, but I don't do, it's more about what happened, the comprehension, because students aren't typically capable, most students, of reading and comprehending everything in the short amount of time that we have and thinking critically. You know, that's a lot to ask. So I always have them read it ahead of time. Where we differ is I'm not so kind about letting them choose how they're going to do it. I'm a little bit more, I require certain things. One thing I use a lot is the discussion board. And I know you're all thinking, how in the world would I ever do that? That that'd be graded. And I actually created a numbers pro, it's like Excel for those of you who are not Mac people, but where it has automatic comments, and I just put one sentence that acknowledges that I have read, you know, something specific, so that they know that I've specifically read their work. And I have found this to be incredibly helpful. I require that they do it by the first day the reading is due, so they have to have thought about it. And I'm a pretty hard grader on it. When I say that, I insist that they post that day, but I also make allowances. The discussion board makes allowances for, you can be wrong, that's okay. I wanna see that you're thinking. Don't copy from somebody else, don't just throw out the first, you know, don't give me a fact and pretend like you were thinking about it. I just wanna see that you were thinking. And if you get it wrong, if it doesn't, you know, if we find that it doesn't pan out in the end, that's okay. You can get full points for it. But I want to see that you're thinking. So it allows them some room to make mistakes and to really kind of work with this stuff and learn how to do it without, you know, it's not a high stakes thing. It's a high stakes if they don't post it, though, because, or if they just, you know, copy what the other person said. That ends up being high stakes. Well, I shouldn't have gotten into the discussion board yet. One of the things that I have them do is read the work and summarize it in a very brief, like a paragraph. I don't want, you know, 3 pages of summary when I give them a page to read or something, which is typically what happens. Well, no, that's not true. Usually I get a sentence if I give them a page. But I do insist that they do, you know, learn to write briefly and that they give the thesis and main points. And that they do it in their own words. This is something that I learned from the facts class that I did. was I realized the students weren't reading the instructions, and so I had them start writing the instructions ahead of time as one of the assignments for the assignment, writing the instructions out in their own words. Well, the first time we did that, they copied the instructions from my sheet and put it on their own sheet because I have them, you know, type it up. And I said, wait, that's not in your own words. What does that mean? And when I asked them what that meant, they just kind of stopped and looked at me. Well, they hadn't thought about it because all they did was copy and paste. And that's a very easy, you know, way to do something without using your brain at all. When I had them actually start writing it in their own words, and I would give them zeros if they didn't. So that's part of it. You have to apply points to everything. If you don't do points, they're not going to do it. That's been my experience. So when I had them actually start writing it out in their own words, they were better at it because they were forced to do it. I was finding out that they would just ask their friends what they were supposed to do, and then they'd get mad because that wasn't what they were supposed to do. So this forced them to start really looking at the instructions themselves. So everything has to be in their own words. I don't want, you know, four lines of a quote and then, you know, according to. Everything has to be in their own words. The next thing that I do for the preparation is I ask specific questions of the works, depending on, you know, what that work is. I never ask fact-finding questions. That should be in the summary, as far as I'm concerned. The major facts should be in the summary. I ask thinking questions, so they have to think about it. They have to come up with some kind of an answer based on some kind of evidence. I also strongly believe and have proven over and over again that the higher the standards, the higher the results. I tried just give me your ideas about it, just respond to it kind of approach, and that was a train wreck. So instead, what I started doing was requiring that they do certain things and asking specific questions that required critical thinking. And I mean, the results were tremendous. The conversations were better. They understood better. But again, they were forced to go in and really dig into the material to find it. Again, there were points attached. It doesn't work without points. So as you see in the last one, points help a lot. Okay, and so these are the kind of questions, this sort of Socratic method. And actually, the place that I got this from is a wonderful resource. It's called the Critical Thinking Community. I think, is that it? The Critical Thinking Community. And I put a web link on there for you. And they have just a tremendous amount of resources that I've been using for quite some time. And these are derived from PW Richards, I can't remember right now, but it's a really good resource. So there are six basic questions, types of questions. One is clarification. We're clarifying, we want the student to clarify what is going on in the reading, or what is going on with what they're saying. The next one is assumptions. What assumptions does the reading rely on? What assumptions are you relying on for your responses to the reading? Are there any other assumptions that we can make from that? The third one, reasons and evidence, and I'm sure you all are very familiar with how, a typical response is, because I believe it, and because it's my opinion, and I can have my opinion. The reasons and evidence requires that they, or gets them thinking about how they can prove what they're saying, not just based on opinion, but with what's in the work, what their experiences are that they can show an actual analogy to, not just very specific exceptions, right, but that makes sense to do that. The criteria that they're using to base something on, because as we know, depending on the criteria, answers can change, right? The next, number four, is viewpoints and perceptions, perspectives, I'm sorry. And so it depends on, as we all know, again, who's saying it and where it's coming from and what one has to benefit from. So we want to, and students very often don't realize this, if it's in print, it's true. And they don't necessarily pay attention to who is actually saying that and what that person or that business has to benefit from that. So I call it the rhetorical situation. So where is that coming from, and what does that person or entity have to benefit from or to lose from? And likewise, what does the opposite of whatever is being presented, what does that group or entity have to gain or benefit from? And asking them to actually think about these things is important. So this is the guidance I'm talking about. We're asking specific questions, but we're not giving them the answer, right? We're trying to guide them to understand what's important to look at. Implications and consequences. So what are the generalizations that you're making? What are, how does one thing affect another? How does what you're claiming is happening here affect the outcome of something else? How does it, I think comparing to what you've learned in the past is crucial. I constantly bring back in what we've talked about in previous discussions, and we compare and contrast, and we're always mixing everything in, and they get used to that. At first, you know, they kind of stumble around, but then they get used to it, and they start making those comparisons, and they start saying, oh, right, like this, and that, I think, helps them apply what they're learning to situations that are not so obvious. So again, I think it's practice. And then questions about questions. So what's relevant about this? Why am I asking this? What do you think is important about this question? Do we need to be talking about this? Very often, they just don't think it's relevant at all in any way. And so if you can apply it to their lives, and I think that is probably the number one piece of advice I would give, apply it to their lives. The more you can apply it to their lives, the more they understand what it is. They kind of have that aha moment if you can make something that is seemingly abstract to them and has no bearing on their own lives, if you can apply it to their own lives. Then they are very much more willing to dig into it because they think it affects them. So we've got, we're all like that. We've got a little narcissism, right? We want to, if it doesn't affect us, we want to move on. We're too busy for that. And so I think that's the number one advice I would give, is to make sure you always are finding ways to apply it. So what I want to do is go ahead and try it with you all. Can I get up and walk around? I'm not very good at sitting down when I'm discussing. Okay, yeah, if I trip, please don't laugh. Does everybody have one of these? Did you go in? Okay, on the back side, why don't you take just a few minutes and read. There's an article back there. Okay, I just want to reiterate that I would never do this with a student class, okay, that I would have them read it ahead of time, but I didn't think you all would appease me if I emailed this to you and I gave you an assignment before I came in. So, and I was about to handle it. Yeah. So, what do you think? Is this an accurate description?
Absolutely.
Okay, does anybody disagree with that, or are we all pretty much on the same? Okay, so what are we assuming here? What are your assumptions? What do we have to assume by reading this article? What kind of assumptions underlie this
this idea that students are too entitled. Looking at the article itself, what does the article tell us? What are the assumptions the article relies on?
They're the consumer and we're the product.
Oh, okay, it assumes that, right? What else? Let me give you one just to kind of get you going. It assumes that students are wrong, right? The students are wrong for feeling this entitlement or for having this experience, and that we are right if we feel this way, right? So that there's one assumption. Right? So can you think of any more assumptions that might come from this?
That all students in all courses or learning paths act the same way.
Okay, right. We kind of generalized, right? So there's a generalization here. Yeah, it's assuming that they're lazy. So there's a sense that entitlement means a sort of intent, right? An obnoxious intent, maybe, right? Good. Anything else that y'all can think of?
Their priorities are changing.
That what?
Their priorities are changing.
That their priorities are changing. Is that what this assumes, or is that an alternative assumption? Well, and how would we determine that? Can we find a place in the text itself that might...
Mm-hmm. This is a different assumption. It assumes that school and learning isn't as important as the other things they have going on in their life.
Exactly. If you look at the last sentence in the first paragraph, it says many students also treat the classroom as an annoying interruption in their social lives and conduct themselves poorly. Is it an annoying interruption in their social lives? Frankly, sometimes it's an annoying interruption in my own life. Right? So, it assumes that education is somehow more important.
I think it assumes that our vision of what education is very different from their vision of what education is.
It assumes a certain vision of education.
Yeah.
Or how students are supposed to be.
Yeah.
We're assuming students are supposed to come in and be serious and put this first.
Right.
And make this their priority over everything else.
Okay.
And it also is a long-term vision, is what I'm thinking about. You know,
okay.
I see education as you have to do this to prepare you for, and they see education as this is something I have to get through to get on with my life.
All right.
They don't see it as the foundation for their life.
Okay. And is it the foundation for their life?
That's definitely my assumption.
Could be, could not be.
Sure. Absolutely?
Absolutely.
Are there any...
I didn't believe that.
Are there any possible alternatives to that? Is there any situation where you can think
of... Not for a student who's chosen to come here.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are alternatives for young. There are alternatives to young people.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk about our students. Are there students? Do all our students choose to come here?
No.
Nominally.
No?
No.
Why? What makes you say that?
Because some parents may
have.
Yeah. Or
we have a little bit of parental influence going on, don't we?
But it's also it may be the only school they could get into, and they didn't. It was their bottom choice. They would rather be elsewhere. Some don't want to be away from home, but they had to because this was a school. Or the only one they could afford. Many reasons they're here, but not because, Xavier is the school I really wanted to be at.
Okay, right, so that's a little bit different of an assumption, right, than what you're saying, because what you're saying is that, yes, that is the assumption. I'm absolutely sure that is what's best for them. Is that what you said? Am I paraphrasing you correctly or not?
Not exactly, but I operate from the assumption that, it's not an assumption. This is a private school. No one makes you come to a private school.
Except parents, maybe?
Parents.
They're 18.
Yeah,
they don't have to.
Yeah,
pressure.
But the pressure.
Some kids have to take certain majors because their parents are making them and they don't want it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
So, and they're here at the school, and they don't want to be at school.
Well, let's.
Well, I would just say, well, you have chosen to do what your parents are telling you. I don't.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't. I don't know how to operate unless I can assume that they want to be here.
Okay, now there's a good question. How do we operate if we think something different than they want to be here, or that they that it's the best thing for them? What are the alternatives to thinking that way? Are there alternatives? Is there any possibility for thinking differently about how we think about the students?
Yes.
How?
Yes.
Like what?
We have to motivate, encourage, make this a place where they want to be. Even though they come not choosing to be here, we have to facilitate the environment such that they are engaged and they want to stay and they want to do their best.
Okay.
I think we assume too much that they just really come here because they really want to learn.
Right, that I agree with that. And a lot of them just want the degree so they can
get a job.
Okay, right. So there's maybe a difference here then in thinking about the value of learning versus the value of the degree. So what do we as teachers do
and
to...
And learning optimally.
And what?
And learning optimal, not learning...
Not just the minimum.
Okay, now just
give an eye, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to get you back in this. So they use
some of the things that students, they, you know, like when they're just skimming by, right?
Mm-hmm.
I will say, you know, I ask them what they want to do. Oh, I want to go to graduate school. Well, the harsh reality is, it's really hard to get into graduate school, even when you have a 3.5 or higher.
Mm-hmm.
At a 2 point, I can't say that you won't get into a graduate school, but it's going to be really difficult. And it's going to be really difficult if you have a withdrawal on every semester. You know, and so I point out, and it's like, not only that, you've spent a lot of time and a lot of money on that withdrawal.
So there, in what you're saying, we also then rely on the assumption that they understand this and that they can see far enough in advance to understand the repercussions, the consequences of what they're doing. Because when we were that age, we most certainly did. We were much more mature.
Well, that's why I tell them. This is what happened, right?
Well,
they obviously don't know. One student said, well, I'll just withdraw and start at another school. I'm like...
Uh-huh.
But this transcript will follow you.
Okay.
And if you don't, if you get into graduate school and you don't send this transcript and they find out.
But you assume then that they believe you.
Because you, what you just said about our generation, because he says, the authors state, these kids today, quotation marks. So they're making an assumption that, well, you know, today they just, you know.
Well, and if we look down at the bottom of the last paragraph, wait, where was that?
Where every generation claims the next one has been called. Is that what you're...
Yeah, where is that?
Yeah.
Right in the middle.
Because you just said, well, our generation, we were in school, you know.
But it really may be true this time.
Yeah.
It really may be true this time.
Us.
Well, yeah, because I'm not part of the one being talked about.
You know, I often think that there probably were lots of people like that all along,
mm-hmm.
but we, the ones who ended up on college faculties, are the ones who really liked it.
Right.
We never wanted to leave
school.
Probably were a lot more motivated.
And should we think then about that, is everyone that we're teaching going to end up in academia?
Oh, well, no.
And can we realistically say that every business person out there, now just let me bring up George Bush, who I think maybe flunked a few, right? That success requires then the kind of interaction we have with the engagement we have with academics. I want to move to something else quick because we only have 5 minutes because Bart's rushing me. but I want to ask you all to think about this too because I think this is a really crucial part of this. What let's look at biases that perhaps exist in this and what are the consequences for not thinking like this. If we buy into this argument that students are too entitled, what is in it for, who's saying this? What do the people who are saying this have to lose or gain? Remember we talked about that? What do we have to lose or to gain by either presenting it this way or thinking about it in a different way?
Well, if we accept it, then we put the blame on them.
Okay.
And we don't have to
then
be responsible for how we teach.
Altruistic teachers, right? Exactly. Good. Good. And
I don't necessarily agree with that. But if we, the flip side though is if we reject this, okay, well, they're not here by choice for whatever reason, this devolves into high school, where, yeah, everyone is forced to be there because there are truancy laws.
But I think we're talking everyone and no one, and mm-hmm. to recognize there is a spectrum, and there's a bell curve, and there are a few that really want to be and are going to probably end up being academics, but
mm-hmm.
the majority of them are here for other reasons, and not necessarily because they have to be and they don't want to be, but they have multiple reasons for being here. And to acknowledge it's not everyone doesn't want to be here and everyone wants to. We have to kind of open our assumptions to figure out who wants to be in here, wants to learn, and wants to do that, and who is here for what reason. And when you can figure out what reason they're here for, you can kind of...
And then also working within those reasons, right? That it's not a one question or another, and we insist that the students think critically about all these things, but when then maybe when we're kind of put in that position where we have to do that on something that is kind of hurtful, right? We don't want to think that we're not thinking about the students. But I want to ask you all a question, and I want to do a couple more of these real quick. Let's take a look at the first paragraph, middle of it. It says, arguing that their professors, it goes on to say that similar variations of blaming their professors if they don't pass a class, arguing that their professors are not teaching right. Faculty members concur that these kids today not only expect to be spoon-fed information and assignments, they also refuse to take responsibility for their work and its quality. And I'm just going to throw out a few things that I, you know, could take a lot. I mean, we could do this for days. I could do this for days. I love this stuff. But some of the questions I might ask are, do we spoon feed them? Think about what we do. I constantly hear, and I'm one of them who does it. I'm so busy. I don't have time for this. And I don't know how many of you love grading, but I'm not one of them. How many times do we just kind of let that go because we don't have time to deal with it? Or how many times, instead of listening to the whole class gripe, do we go ahead and, all right, I'm going to throw this quiz away this one time, right? Never again. Well, until next time.
Yeah.
Right? Or how many times do we let them get up? How many times do we not stand up for what we think because... evaluations, they have to do evaluations at the end, right?
Mm-hmm.
And after all, those do have an impact, right? So, of course, I wouldn't say these things in a discussion. Well, yeah, I probably would eventually, but I would try to see how much I could get you all to think about these different ways of looking at this, not just to implicate self. And please notice, too, that I chose something that I knew every one of you, we're going to be, I knew we were going to be in on this together, because trust me, I feel this way too. But I knew that this was going to be a heartfelt belief, right? What I wanted to do was show you that even something you feel so strongly about, you can get people to start thinking about in new ways. And that's what you want to do with the students. So I have another one that I'm going to hand out, and you all are teaching freshman seminar, right? Okay, and you were using the Fast Food Nation. Oh, that wasn't this year?
Last semester.
In the fall.
Last semester. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I took one out of Fast Food Nation because I thought I was going to show you all how to give you an example for what you were doing. But I took an excerpt out of here, and what I did was I just put some questions. I just did some internet searches to find some things that might offer ways to relook at a situation. And so it's an excerpt from the book, and then there are questions down underneath that I've just separated, and I've chosen from different places just to offer different ways to look at this particular excerpt and what's going on. And, in fact, the whole chapter, it comes from behind the counter, and there's a lot in there about, how detrimental it is to, as a labor force, the minimum wage, that the whole section is about, it not being a good place to work. And so I've just offered some ways to look at it in a different way. You'll notice that a great deal of this has African American, the positives for African Americans. Of course, I'm doing that because we want to them to apply it to their own lives. Okay, so those are going to be the important ones to bring in, right? Okay, look, I'm on time. And I'm sorry we don't even have time for questions.
Well, we want to be respectful. We have this room. We want to be respectful of your time. We want to encourage you to fill out that evaluation form before you leave. But if anybody wants to linger or can linger and to talk, please feel free.
I just have one question. If you don't have a textbook, who do we engage them in a discussion? Actually, in the second semester of freshman seminar, we don't have a textbook per se. So it's kind of hard to bring topics and make them.
What I would do is find a whatever you are talking about, discussing, I would find some. I mean, the internet is such a great resource. And just to, you know, print out, some, like the one that I just gave you all, I printed that out from a source last night on the computer, right? I found it on Google because I wanted something that would be applicable for this workshop. You print something out like that?
I did that, like something from the topic, daily news, something like that.
Yeah. And if you can make it applicable to what you're doing in class so they feel like it's, you know, if they feel like it's busy work, they're going to be upset, right? So if you can apply it to the class or to, if you're talking about, you know, social current events, of course, then that would be certainly appropriate.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, for your book clubs, do you do that 1 week for each one, or do you have 2 weeks, or what's the time that you
It's
that?
Throughout the semester. I have it, you know, balanced. But they all know, and they know, and I'm reminding them, this is book club week, and so they
know.
But
you have 1 week for each work?
For each book.
So it's one session per book.
Right, so there were 4 weeks of the semester that was book club.
How would you suggest structuring a group discussion in a freshman seminar class where there's typically 2 dozen people?
And you only meet once a week. Well, that's kind of difficult. I mean, I guess what you could do is you could split them up one day and get a good friend of yours who needs to put stuff about collegiality on his or her report and say, would you come in? And maybe something you could do for one of the other teachers and say, I want to take the group, take them someplace different. We'll sit outside. We go to the UC, and we're just going to sit together and do that. And it could be something you have to coordinate, but I do think it's worth pursuing. I really do, because I'm telling you, it's that whole Socratic thing, you know? Mm-hmm. They are bringing up stuff on their own. They are making these observations and such. Their understanding of the book is much better after the discussion than it is before they come in, but they're getting it on their own through each other and not so much me. I mean, I bring up some things, but they're getting it. They're getting it. And in a better way, I think. So, yeah, that would be something to work on. I mean,
right. Well, they're encouraging people to team up, the instructors from different sectors to team up.
Or even ask someone who, you know, again, who might not even be teaching the course, but just say, hey, you know, we're working on this, and you teach sociology, and I thought this might be interesting that you took these people and whatever, you know. Just for something just a little bit different. And yeah, it's asking someone to do something, but that's what we're supposed to do around here.
And the smaller the group, the more invested they feel, too.
They really do. Right. They actually say stuff.
I teach Louisiana history. I use a novel by Ernest Gaines, Catherine Cartier.
Okay.
And usually we wait till the end of the semester because that's the time curve, the novel is set, and we're exploring different themes of, you know, racial identity and all these different things. So I'm thinking of this book club idea. Mm-hmm.
I would tell them, I mean, me, I hate talking about so many pages and so many pages and that kind of thing. But one thing I should add is that I have book club. Let's say this week I had book club. When we all meet again on Tuesday, we're going to, as a class now in traditional classroom, still talk a bit about the book. So it's just not that one-shot thing. But the original exploration.
Get the characters confused.
Yeah, I can see. But you know, just kind of that initial exploration where they can kind of sit back and, again, make it a relaxing atmosphere.
Right.
Let them have food. Let them sit around a comfortable place and make it special. Make it more intimate. And they like it. They like it, and I tell you.
They like the book when they're finished. It's getting them, for me, because, you know, coming at it from a different perspective, you know, thinking about more what I want them to take rather than
And also the way you can schedule your work is saying, now note, I'm giving you some time here because this book is coming up.
Right.
And I always give a quiz just to make sure, keep them honest.
Right, exactly.
You know, and as you saw, my quiz is very, except for the last two,
well,
were more traditional.
That
but yeah,
was because it's A, out of print, it's so hard to find anything. So I know they can't, you know, it's not something they're going to go look
good
up. But yeah, like,
I tell you what, when I saw the annotations they made on Second Skim, which I knew was a difficult book, they annotated. They really did. They actually made real notes. I was pleased with how well, and that was just something I just came to me. What if I make them do this? Because I didn't think it was fair to ask them like a traditional quiz thing or even to use the words because I knew it was such a weird book. They would be lost. And I didn't want to penalize them on that, but I did want to show them, you're getting more of this than what you realize. Just because the book doesn't really make sense at the end, that's the book. It's postmodernism. They're like, what? I said, that's it. Good, good.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Really
thanks for lunch.
Yeah.